Vegas Bad Boy of Podcasting is an entertainment-based wrestling program. The opinions shared are that of the host and their guests. Some celebrity voices are impersonated and usually not well. This program is not intended for kids and certain adults. Listener's discretion is advised. You have been warned. Now let's get ready to podcast. This is a special edition with our guest.
Wait for it!
Nick Otis.
We have a special guest with us. Let me first just kind of just read off. I mean, the man have large amounts of accolades, but I'm just going to do just a small amount. The National Treasure World Champion, Tag Team Champion, the man with the 10 pounds of gold. He's an esteemed author. And he's the current NWA champion. Let's give it up for Nick Otis.
All right, gentlemen.
Hey, how are you, Nick?
I'm great. We're off to a flying start, right?
Just swell.
Right.
Yes.
All right, let's kick
Good
it
job,
off.
DJ Impact.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. I'm doing a lot over here.
Yeah, man, you're holding it down.
Thank you, I appreciate it.
So let's start with a very easy thing here, and that is, you called us because of the fact that it's time for bed for the little fella. What is it like being a dad in all this craziness of a wrestling world? How are you finding it in terms of, is it bringing a balance or a piece and happiness to you?
Oh. I can honestly say it was the most important thing in terms of my personality, I think, that's ever happened to me, because and in many ways it's also sort of linked to my career resurgence, I think, because yeah. I you know, I don't think it's any secret that I sort of got a lot of opportunities maybe a tad too young, you know, and was sort of thrown in at the deep end. And sort of, even though I had a lot of good years at TNA, it was kind of, I was always sort of trying to catch up, you know, my ability was trying to catch up with my position, if that makes sense.
Right. Yeah.
And you know, it's just, it's a very, you know, when you have self-awareness, which I think is so important if you want to succeed in this business, especially over a long period of time, like you can't, you know it, you know, like the whole time I was doing, even when I was the world champion in TNA, I knew deep down, I knew like, I'm not quite ready for this, but I'm almost ready. So I'm going to have to just be ready. And I just thought that was the way it worked, you know, and I just had to sort of, and I was, you know, still trying to learn on the fly, and just, it was just, God, I was mentally like really burned out, I think, because just between that and you know, my personal situation at the time, it wasn't like anything bad. It was just, you know, that it, when you get so sort of wrapped up in your career like that, it just kind of bleeds over into everything else. So I was just kind of for lack of a term, I was kind of a shit to people, you know, and I didn't mean to be. I was like, I was cool with, like, when I was in Tampa with my friends in Tampa who were sort of disconnected from the wrestling business, like I was a totally different person, but anybody else in my life who was sort of linked to my career or the wrestling business or anything else, it's just, I was so angry, you know, and felt very sort of betrayed and isolated and paranoid. And it just, when my son was born, it just, or even before, you know, even when we found out that she was pregnant, it was just like, it was just like, I had this very, very defined sort of, moment where I went, okay, like, grow up, you know,
right.
Like, this is, like, this is stupid, you know, you're just like, this, like, who gives a shit, you know, like, you're just, you know, get on with it. And just, it's about, I think the best thing about it was that it reminded me that at the end of the day, it's a business,
right?
And it's just, it's, you have to do what's right to, you know, make money for your family. Or for your son, you know, and before that, I had never even really thought of that. Like, I would, you know, negotiated contracts and, you know, was pretty, I felt like I was sort of pretty hard nosed and, you know, certainly wasn't just like, I wasn't some mark who was just going to take whatever they gave me. I always made sure I sort of stood up for myself. but it wasn't sort of my primary focus, right. You know. So yeah. When I had a guaranteed contract. My last contract with TNA was guaranteed contract, meaning they couldn't fire me, you know, unless I breached the contract. It was a legitimate sort of guaranteed contract, and I gave back a lot of money on that. And I think while that was obviously a smart move, I probably took advantage of it a little bit, and I was, you know, difficult to deal with, and it cost me in the long run, because then it was like, once that deal was over, it was like, you know, they weren't gonna match it.
Yeah.
And I knew I didn't want to stay at that point, because they had, you know, they had made a very clear statement with me. Do you know what I mean? In my last year.
Yeah.
And I just went, okay, got it. You know what I mean? Like, and
yeah.
Lesson learned, and went and dust myself off. And it took me a couple of years to sort of figure out where my niche was going to be in the business and everything else. And sort of, and that you needed a little bit of that. I had to eat a bit of humble pie, you know what I mean? But
sure.
But having my son really made that much easier, because it took my pride out of the equation.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
It was always just kind of like, all right, what's the best move here? What's going to keep me going long-term. I mean, I can't divulge too much, you know, but
right.
Even yesterday, for example, we kind of had a brief discussion, you know, between me and Billy and Dave at the NWA, and sort of about my future, like sort of my deal and whatnot. And I just kind of went, let's focus on getting this right and building this, you know what I mean? And yeah. Getting this business going. Like, don't worry about me. Like, you know, what you're paying me is fine. And because I believed in being loyal and sort of, setting myself up long term, because I, you know, in the back of my mind, I'm going, let's do what's right long term, you know, and that's, I've completely changed my outlook in that respect, because I always think of things now in terms of like, where's this going to put me in 5 years, 10 years, you know, whereas before it was just like, I want everything now.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it also, it puts a new perspective, you know, when you say long term. You're looking now at being a father. So in a sense, you're also looking at the world around you through long-term eyes, which,
yeah,
you know, when you're a reckless youth, it's just like, you know, screw everyone. I'm fucking the shit. And, you know, I take, you know, I'll take what's mine, and I'm a conqueror. And, you know, when we all have been in the crazy fucking situations.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah. And the wrestling business especially is so myopic, you know, like you can just be people within it's because it's, you know, because we're in this sort of weird gray area in the entertainment business between sports, legitimate entertainment, and the circus, you know, like it doesn't matter how much money, you know, WWE makes, doesn't matter what the stock price is. It doesn't matter how legitimate the business is in so many ways and how much revenue it generates. And, you know, at the end of the day, the perception of wrestling is still, you know, we're still having to work every day to just legitimize ourselves a little bit more. Like, we're still not really considered. I still don't think we're treated fairly in that respect by the rest of the world. So there's a tendency by people in the business to sort of, you know, live in the bubble and just kind of shut everybody else out and go, okay, fine, fuck everybody else. But you know. I try not to do that, because I think that's a very unhealthy place to be if you're not careful.
And have you become now being a dad, have you gotten to the phases in the house? Is there like, is Baby Shark playing? What is his niche that you're going, I never thought I saw myself doing this.
He's Yeah, what are you checking your man card? I don't mind talking about this stuff. Honestly, it's funny. God, he's four, so it's like he's definitely like in the sort of play fighting. You know, he's always wanting always jumping on me, and you know, so he's like, his favorite thing to do is like, he'll go, I'm gonna get your collarbone, you know, and, like, drive his thumbs in. Like, he's a heel.
Oh, nice. That's awesome. Like, love it.
It's all dirty tactics, all eye rakes and, you know, pressure points. And I think he's been watching Marty. Yeah. This is joint manipulation and pressure point stuff.
You know? Right.
But, it's Peppa Pig, Hey Dougie, Llama Llama. That's his new favorite one. It's on Netflix, Llama Llama.
Oh, so my God.
It's brutal.
Yeah.
Very brutal. But, awesome. Yeah, and then, like, toys-wise, it's, like, trains and... Mm-hmm. He's all about Legos now, and God, yeah, there's just stuff everywhere, always.
I mean, that's the beauty of it. Like, I myself, you know, I've never had any kids, and DJ and Lucky have kids themselves, and their kids are now, you know, in that next phase of some are getting ready to go into high school almost, and some are just past.
I am not looking forward to that.
I'm not either, Nick.
Yeah. It just gets better.
Yeah.
So right. Along those lines, you know, taking it back, you've been in the business for, you know, 14 years. What got you interested in pro wrestling? This is King Lucky.
What got me interested in it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So when I was, you know, growing up in England, the WWF was it, you know, like it was like that, you know, it's, as far as we were concerned, like no other wrestling existed, you know, like I remember vaguely, like the occasional friend of mine at school would say like, oh, do you ever watch WCW? Mm. You know, but it was very, WWF was very dominant in the UK, you know, in the early 90s. And then by the time, you know, the Monday Night Wars kind of started, it started to turn the tide a little bit, but it was still very much like WWF. You know, no, I don't really believe outside of sort of the early days of Smart Marks. I don't believe in the UK like WCW was ever considered anything except number two. And right. I don't mean that as you know, derisively to them. It's just kind of I just remember that perception.
Right.
And so like even as a kid when I didn't necessarily watch it sort of religiously, it's like their marketing was so good that you knew who everybody was.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Bret the Hitman Hart was like my first hero.
Oh,
you know,
that's
like
awesome.
he was like along with like Leonardo from Ninja Turtles. So it was like Leonardo and Bret Hart, you know, and British Bulldog, David yeah. Boy Smith. So it was sort of obviously SummerSlam 92 was just, you know, just so it just felt very special to British kids because it was like even though Bret was Canadian, like he was every kid in England's favorite wrestler.
Right.
Yeah. It felt that way anyway, like he was mine and he's, you know, he's been my hero ever since. But like, when all the sort of early days of the Attitude Era were starting to spark, I was very much a sports kid and I was really starting to come into my own in terms of sort of some legitimate athletic competitions. So I was like, getting ready to, you know, I did the national championships in swimming and tennis, and I was having tryouts for sort of better quality football clubs, you know, soccer. Right. And, yeah, soccer. You hear the disdain in my voice. Yeah. So I was kind of not, I wasn't really watching then. It was, I remember like some of my mates at school said to me, you know, have you watched wrestling recently? And I'm like, no, not really. Like, you know, just here and there or whatever, and they were like, oh, you gotta watch it, like Shawn Michaels is doing this new thing called DX, it's crazy, like they're like, you know, they're mooning people and stuff, and it really genuinely was, you know, like exactly how you would imagine the Attitude Era to sort of catch on. Like I just remember some of my buddies telling me about it and then watching it and then just being like, oh, this is it, like this is the greatest thing I've ever seen. And then after that it just coincided with me becoming a teenager and getting hormones and like, you know what I mean, and
yeah.
having an ego. So I was like, I started lifting weights, I was like, I was, you know, cutting promos all the time and just, you know, just being a complete buffoon. And like pretty soon after that I realized that I was totally dedicated to working out, and like I was like fixated on it. I was like, I'm gonna get big, because I was skinny, you know what I mean?
Right.
And
did you,
and it just,
is that when you,
sorry, yeah,
is that when you first started stumbling into Arnold Schwarzenegger's routines and workouts, or
yeah,
was that later?
So I started essentially, you know, bodybuilding, right? Like, or, you know, just sort of getting really into the physical culture, because I wanted to get big for wrestling, because I wanted to be a wrestler. But right. then very quickly after that, it was like, I kept seeing Arnold. And I think my sister told me, because I'm the youngest of five, and like my older sister told me that even she said, when I was very small, like, I don't remember this, but she said when I was really small, I would, if I was like, if I got upset with her about something, or, you know, was throwing a tantrum, I would say, one day I'm going to lift weights and I'm going to be really big and strong and I'm going to beat you all up, you know what I mean? she's, you know, so I think I've always sort of had a, you know, like a lot of little boys, you know, you're like into superheroes and that kind of thing. So I think I always had a sort of in the back of my mind, a subconscious desire to look a certain way and, you know, have a certain physical presence and stuff. And then I found wrestling, and it just, I knew like sports was fun. Like, and I was a good athlete, you know, I was a pretty good athlete, but it just wasn't, there was something missing from it to make me really fully dedicated to it. You know what I mean? Like
right.
even, and then when, and it suddenly just clicked me, you know, when I was about 13 or 14, it suddenly resonated like, oh shit, you want to be a pro wrestler. Like that's that was it. Like I was, you know, I made up my mind.
Yeah. Now you also participated in the Gladiators. So
yeah.
Under the name Oblivion. Do you feel like that helped you, you know, kind of prepare for pro wrestling?
Very excited about that.
Right.
I thought it was going to take an unexpected turn there.
Yeah.
That was honestly like one of the best things that ever happened to me, because it was so much fun. I made friends from that will be friends for life.
That's awesome.
And like I can't describe to you how, you know, I'm not suggesting that I was this giant celebrity in the UK or whatever, but considering, but from being, I was, you know, 20, I think, when I went for the auditions for that, had no, Tom Latimer was there with me, Brown.
Right. Yeah.
We
yeah.
went to the auditions together. And one of my best friends on the planet, Dan, he was there too. And I have a funny story about the tryouts that I'll tell you in a second, but that show was like, none of us expected to even have a shot, you know, like we got there and there was like 50 guys there, and we recognized about 25 of them from like movies and TV shows and film magazines and stuff. So we were just like, we're fucked. Like, we're never going to get this. And, but then like we were all wrestling full time on the Dixon circuit. So we wrestled like 5-6 days a week, you know, through the whole summer. So we were like, so our cardio was like untouchable at the time. Yeah. And I never even thought about it back then. Now I'm like constantly thinking about it, but, and then so they got these assault courses and stuff, and I just went, fuck it, I'm just gonna go balls to the wall and just, you know, what the hell, there's nothing to lose. I ended up like smashing, like, you know, doing really good times and being in like the top 10 and going like, damn, like maybe I actually have a chance.
Yeah.
And then they turned the cameras on, and they just literally showed up. They told everyone to take a rest, and then they did the old, I've heard that WWE do this at tryouts too, but I've never been to one, so I don't know for sure. But they just suddenly pulled cameras out on everyone when they weren't expecting it, and being like, hey, you talk, you know, go, yeah. you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like, and you just saw all these guys just fold like a deck of cards. I mean, just going like, oh, I'm going to destroy you. You know, just saying like really shit, generic stuff. And I, you know, we all had about 5 or 6 like go-to promos that we would do pretty much every night, if whether you were a heel or a babyface, because you would switch up all the time on the camps. So they just put it in my face, and I literally just reeled off some like, you know, pro wrestling 101 stuff, and you could just see all the producers go like, oh, okay. and then I got the gig. But I'm going the long way around here, but the thing that I'll never forget about that more than anything was how you hear about quote unquote, you know, overnight celebrities and like overnight success.
Sure.
And I experienced about as close to it as I think that you know, as someone like me ever will. And that was, because when they told me that I had the part, they had us come and do the photo shoots and the green screen shoots and all that sort of stuff for all the commercials and the big reveal and stuff. They had us doing it at like 3 or 4 in the morning. Like they would, you know, and they would take you like undercover night, you know what I mean? Like, so you'd go in the back entrance and things so no one could see you, because it had already, the press already knew that they were bringing it back. And it's hard to explain, but it was such a big show in the 90s in the UK.
Yeah.
That the tabloids were like, it was just one of those shows that tabloids just loved. Like, they were just constantly all about it. You know what I mean? Like, steroids and, you know, affairs and like all this sort of stuff that happened in the 90s. So it was just kind of, there was chum in the water with the tabloids, you know? And so they were so nervous about, you know, any of it getting leaked. And then they said to us, like, okay, May the 1st, I think it was, or that might have been the first episode, I forget, but they were said, like, whatever date, is it like such and such date, that's the day where it all goes out. Billboards, newspapers, TV, radio, like everywhere. Like, it's all happening in like one day. And I'll never forget, like, just like literally going to bed and then getting up the next day and having 300 texts and like just people, you know, like my mom calling me, you know, and all these different things, just going like, have you seen the newspaper? Have you seen this? Have you seen that? Or, like, people texting me, I just saw you at a bus stop. Like, what the hell? Like, you know, I just saw you on the underground. Like, what the hell's going on? Like, you're one of them. Like, this is so crazy. Like, you know, and it was just, I'd never experienced anything like that. And it was like, the next time I went out wherever, it was like, everyone was recognizing me, stopping me. And it was like, you know, it went from nobody knowing who you were at all to suddenly going like, oh, like, people are watching me like while I'm at a restaurant. This is weird, you know.
Yeah, right.
And I was like 21. Oh, I wasn't even 21, I think I was 20. Oh, so wow. It was just so weird for me, because I was just from this little village in the middle of nowhere. And like, so I think but the thing is, like, because of wrestling, I was sort of, I think I was more prepared for it, because I wanted to, because I already wanted that, do you know what I mean?
Right.
Compared to some of these guys who were just sort of bodybuilders or, you know, track and field athletes or Marines and stuff. So they were just kind of like, they didn't have any sort of show business experience at all. At least I had some.
Right. Yeah.
So it was like, I loved it. But it was just, that was always the sort of the real, you know, takeaway thing for that. And I learned so much about TV and about media. And I made a point to spend a lot of time with the producers and just sort of ask a lot of questions and, you know, just sort of, because I always had one eye on working behind the scenes after my wrestling career was finished and stuff like that. And I think that's one of the reasons why I've married so well with the NWA, because I'm sort of part of the process, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So obviously, working on Gladiators, when you came into TNA, you had a gimmick of a modern day gladiator,
yes.
Brutus Magnus. Excuse me. Tell me a little bit about that and how that happened.
Brutal Brutus Magnus. All right. So, long story short, it's no secret that the creative team at TNA in 2009. Was slightly odd. It was Vince Russo, but with a filter of Dutch Mantel, and like Jeff Jarrett. Jim Cornette was an agent. So like, not, and here's where I diplomatically say that I don't necessarily 100% agree with any one of those guys' individual, like, you know, theories and philosophies on wrestling,
right? Yeah,
but I can tell you that putting them lot together is a fucking waste of time. Because they're all going to disagree with each other, so what you end up with is this weird hodgepodge of stuff. Add to that the fact that clearly the sort of rep that I came in with was that Dixie basically just wanted me because I was on the TV show, which is true. The problem is, they just heard gladiators and didn't know what that meant. I think they thought, Vince genuinely thought that it was a like a Roman gladiator, you know.
Oh, wow.
Like the movie.
Yeah.
Not American gladiators.
Right. Right.
You know, because we just called it gladiators. And so I get to Nashville to shoot these vignettes because they're going like, oh, yeah, you're gonna have vignettes. And all of a sudden, I was thinking, like, wow, this is so cool, you know, because a lot of my friends at the time, including Tom, were getting signed to developmental deals and going to Tampa for FCW and, right. you know, with WWE. So I was, and, you know, so we were obviously always, like, communicating with each other. And they were all jealous, like, oh, you're getting vignettes and, like, you're getting to go on TV and, you know, like, you know, you wrestle with, like, Kurt Angle and Samoa Joe and AJ Styles and all, you know, because TNA had such a good roster back then. That, like,
definitely.
Marty would text me, like, every day, like, what's it like, you know, like, have you met this person yet? Or, you know, this about meeting Kevin Nash, you know, and all this kind of thing. And, but I get to Nashville to do my vignettes and, like, and they had me doing like they have like the Parthenon in Vanderbilt University. So they said, "Oh, we'll have you like running the steps there," and stuff like that. And I was like, "Okay, that's kind of cool, I suppose." You know, like I'm gonna work out clothes. So I'm still thinking like, "All right, you know, it's just they're just gonna sort of lightly play off the word gladiator and put it into my gimmick or something, you know, and that'll be my sort of character, right? Like whatever." Mm-hmm. And then I get to TV. And like they didn't have gear made for me or tell me to get gear made or anything. I just showed up, just did what I thought I should. So I got like some sort of really cheaply made. It was awful. Like this cheaply made like Roman skirt looking thing. And all stuff. And I was just like, it was brutal. And then like Vince Russo was like, oh no, bro. Like this isn't what I had in mind for you at all. And I'm like, well, what did you have? No one's told me what you had in mind for me, you know what I mean? And then, like, and then he gets Jolene, the seamstress, to make me stuff, and it's all that leather stuff with the helmet.
Let me just say really quick, Nick, because I just looked over and Lucky has a picture up right now.
Yes.
And I had forgotten that it was
what a doozy.
Roman dominatrix.
Yes.
Oh Christ! Oh, okay,
yeah. With an arm straps.
Yeah.
So
the helmet.
The funniest thing about this, whole outfit, is the fact that that helmet was not meant to be worn as a helmet. It was like it was gigantic. It was meant to be just like a souvenir.
Oh, wow.
Like it didn't have any inside to it. It was just literally the shell. Like it was meant to be, you know, for some, you know, someone with horrible taste apparently to put on their mantle or something. You know,
oh
what I mean?
My
it was like,
God.
They bought it wow. from. They bought it online from like one of these, you know, moviereplica.com.
Oh,
you know what
God.
I mean? And then, well, so like they gave it to me, and I went, well, this is gigantic. It's like twice the size of a normal head.
Jesus.
And like. So they super glued in a baseball cap into the top of the helmet.
Oh my God.
Stay on my head.
Oh wow. My God.
So put yourself in my position. You just turned 22. You're about to debut on TV. You're surrounded by like all these guys that you idolized, like Kurt Angle, Sting, Booker T, Scott Steiner, Kevin Nash, Mick Foley, you know, like all, and then you've got like the best wrestlers in the business, like Samoa Joe, AJ Styles, all these guys around. And like, you already think like, I don't know if I'm really ready for this.
Yeah.
And then they give you that.
Right.
It's wow. like,
dude, I would have thought it was a rib. That's, oh my God, dude.
There were times where it felt like it, you know what I mean? And I think that honestly, in a weird way, I sort of earned my respect quite quickly with the boys after that because they went, you know what, like once they started to realize like who I was really and I did genuinely really want this and was not just so like a lot of them had no idea who I was, you know what I mean? It was
right.
only when Doug came
yeah.
a couple of months later because they thanked like to, you know, save me and put me in the tag team with him,
yeah,
which, you know, and that's the best thing I can take from it is that at least it made him pull the trigger on signing Doug.
That's yeah awesome.
You know
yeah.
and like he was the one who sort of smartened them all up and said like, no, like he was a wrestler first, you know what I mean? And like, I've vouched for him in the UK and because Doug did, he helped train me at Dropkicks Academy and like went and, you know, put me over to promoters and stuff and got me booked.
Wow. Wow.
So
I didn't realize
and
that.
I have a profound respect for Doug because of what he, you know, what he represents to us Brits, you know what I mean? And the fact that he did that for me, because at the time he was like undoubtedly the number one British wrestler and, you know, in the world, like outside of WWE. And everyone just respected him so much. He's done a lot for me, you know, even before TNA, but in TNA and, you know, and beyond. So,
yeah, that's awesome. Yeah.
Outside of Doug, I mean, you've had like many successful tag teams, right? Do you have a favorite tag team partner, or is Doug it?
It's hard to say because, you know, it's, I suppose it would be like if you had two children, you know what I mean? Like
that's very true. Like,
because I have such love and respect for Joe and Doug, and I hold those different periods of my career both in they're two of the most in terms of my TNA career especially, they're probably the two periods that I kind of have the fondest memories of, you know?
Yeah, right.
Because the tag team was like so fun, and there's a certain safety with when you're in a tag team, right? Like where you, it's kind of like, as long as there aren't loads and loads of tag teams, you're kind of always going to be on the show, and you know, and especially for us, like with British Invasion, we were so fortunate to get married with Beer Money because Beer Money were the hottest act on the show.
Oh, right, yeah.
And we just so that and between we had really good heat. They were the hottest act on the show. It married perfectly, and like so, it was, you know, it was just great. It was like the best place for me to learn because it was Bobby's an impeccable worker, Doug's an impeccable worker, James was super over in a great promo, and you know, and had just had like bags of charisma. So it was like, okay, trial by fire. You know what I mean? Like
right.
Catch up to these guys. Like do your best to hang with these guys, and like you'll be okay.
Yeah.
And they were such professionals that they, you know, that it, they didn't make me look out of place. And then with Joe, it was like British Invasion had finished, and they'd sort of had their first sort of attempt at trying to give me a bit of a singles push. But then like TNA had such a revolving door of who was in charge that every time someone new would come in, first it would be like Bischoff and then Bruce Pritchard later on or whatever, that they didn't know who I was, you know? And right. it's not a knock on them, but like in their world, they're just like, who's this kid? Oh, I've never seen him work. Oh, he's, how old is he? 23? Oh, he's got bags of time. Like, you know, like, and so they would just, and you know, I would get really pissed off and frustrated and be like, why am I not doing anything? You know? And cause I could feel myself getting better, you know? And it just, but it, I can see it from their point of view. If they come in and they've got all these shiny toys to play with, like these big stars and really good wrestlers, like you're going to dedicate your time to them, you know, like you're not going to worry about like, how are we going to get this green British kid over?
Well, that was, and that was one of their problems in TNA.
Well, it was. And it was, I think, because a lot of the time they were just kind of chasing their tail a little bit. They were always worried about this week's show, you know, getting the rating and stuff like that, and you know, that's understandable. I can tell you it's a thankless job. It's hard. Like you can never please everyone, and the roster was probably a little bit too big. Like they probably could have done with having about 10 less guys under contract,
you know? Yeah,
from me looking at it objectively from a business, you know, as a businessman,
right? Yeah.
But but then with Joe it was like, I get it, they knew that they had a money talent in Joe, but they would, Vince, you know, especially would periodically have these sort of things where, you know, these periods where he didn't know what to do with him.
Yeah.
So, and it was just one of those periods. And then so they were like, well, we'll put you in this wild card tag team thing. And I was like super excited about it. It's like, I'm sure Joe didn't give a shit, but I was super excited about it. Cause I was like, I'm such a fan of Joe's. Like, and I immediately started going, well, man, if I can just take his offense, because it was so unique and it was, you know, so over, I was like, I can just kind of insert myself into certain moments. We can make some pretty cool looking like tandems and double teams and stuff. So I just wanted to sort of prove that I would commit to whatever they gave me.
Yeah.
And it was just a weird thing. Like we did one and you could just feel it was the first time I could really feel the audience as far instead of just listening to them. You know, like one I really could, you could feel the audience, because most of them were the same people every week.
Right.
So it was like, you could feel this kind of shift where you could feel like people going like, I like that. That's like, what is this? Yep. Like, this is something. This is. I didn't know I wanted this, and now I want it. You know, and it's kind of those have been a lot of the best things of my career. You know, like I think that's the same thing with the NWA. Like a lot of people were like, I didn't know I wanted this until I saw it. Now I really want it. You know,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because it's just like it's commitment.
Yeah,
yeah. The Main Event Mafia. They had so many legends. What did you gain from that experience, you know, in your time, and how did that all come about?
Yeah, that was awesome. It was honestly like the last really like fun period of my TNA career. Like I really felt like 2013 was undoubtedly like my favorite year in my TNA career because I had a great run in 2012 with Joe as a tag team. Then we'd split up and I'd had two or three good pay-per-view matches with Joe that year, like at the end of that year.
Right.
And then I took time off to go do an acting gig. And like, I came back and I was in like the best shape of my life, came back and it just timed it where I was going to come back in time for the UK thing. So they did a thing where they Aces and Eights took me out and I was going to come back to the babyface. It was like perfectly set up. And even though like Bruce kind of took the wind out of my sails on my first comeback, because, you know, and it's, we've joked about it now, like he chewed me out for something, and I was just like in the moment, you know, and I was just kind of going for it because it was, you know, I got a huge pop at Manchester Arena and like came back and Hogan was like, it was a hell of a pop, brother. And I was just like, is this real? Like, is this a dream? You know what I mean?
Oh, that's awesome.
But like, and then Bruce was like, you stupid idiot. Like, you turned your back to the, he's like, did it tell me all the stuff I did wrong? And he, you know, he was right. But it was just like, was like, what the fuck? Like,
isn't that always the thing too? The executive producer of television, when you're on a set or in wrestling, you think you've had the, you know, just like this euphoric moment. And then there's always the one executive VP who turns around and goes, are you fucking kidding me? You did this wrong.
Yeah. he's a perfectionist. I mean, you know, look who he's learned from.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, like I didn't handle that very well at the time because I was, you know, not very mature, but even despite that, I still had such a good year. Like, you could feel the audience like kind of accepting me. Like we had this, I remember that we had this like four-way number one contenders match. It was me, Joe, Kurt, and Jeff Hardy. And I remember thinking, oh God, like it's supposed to be four baby faces and I'm going to get booed out of the building. Like, you know what I mean? And they didn't. And then like, and I had, you know, and then they made, and all the guys in that match were such professionals that they really made sure that I had a good showing. Cause you could tell they were sort of thinking, yeah, let's like, he's earned it. Like, let's give him a chance. You know what I mean? Like, let's really let him try and get over. And Joe at that point was just so in my corner. Do you know what I mean? He was just like,
right,
fucking go all the way with this guy. Sting had always been like that, you know, by the end of that year, when it finally built to me and Sting and I beat him at the pay-per-view, like he literally came back and said to them, make sure that means something.
Yeah.
You know, in other words, like go all the way with this kid. Do you know what I mean? And it's like that, you know, that whole year was just like, you know, phenomenal for me. Unfortunately, it was sort of jumping the shark in my TNA career, but you know, it is what it is.
But at the same time, and I think you made a really good point. Now, I trained at UPW 2000 to 2002. Joe was my head trainer, and Joe was, let's put it this way, he was only like 2 years in into his career, and he was already head training, you know, new bees into the, you know, into the promotion. So it means a lot. I mean, coming from that standpoint of where you were in your career, that you would have someone like him behind you.
Oh, he did so much for me. Like he gave me everything, you know, honestly. Like if I hadn't been put with him in 2012, they'd have probably fired me by the middle of that year.
Yeah. And it's,
you know, and then I wouldn't have ever been able to learn, you know, what I learned and you know, been able to apply it now.
Did Joe ever pull any ribs or joke around with you? Did he show you that side of himself? Because he's one funny. I mean, he's intimidating on screen, but he's just awesome.
Yeah, no, I love Joe. No, me and Joe are very close. Like I just saw him in New York, you know, during the WrestleMania week, and it was so, you know, he's one of those guys that I'm like always looking forward to see. And yeah, we always had fun together. Like, you know, he's it's funny how I remember sort of being nervous about first meeting him when I first started there, and then just realizing really quickly, like, oh, this guy's really cool. Like, what? Yeah. Like, that's a gimmick. Like, stop being a mark. Like, that's a gimmick.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah.
It's just a character thing. He's not really, he's just really good at portraying that character.
You've got quite the bit of history, you know, with so much talent. Is there a feud that sticks out to you that probably made you? I know you mentioned with Sting, but is there any major feud that you could think of that just really brought it home for you?
I mean, not to beat a dead horse, but probably Joe, you know, like that. I think it wasn't such a feud, but when I did the Bound for Glory series and then I wrestled AJ in the final, having that match with AJ was like, you know, Dave Lagana, actually, I remember he was a writer at the time there. And I remember him pulling me aside and going, that was easily your best showing. Like that, we gave you the ball with this and you absolutely ram it. Like you did exactly what you were supposed to do with this. He's like, you know, just good job kind of thing. Like this whole thing, meaning like the whole tournament, the whole thing, and then the final with AJ, because that to his credit, that was all Jeff Jarrett. Like he produced the shit out of that. It was so good, you know, and he knew exactly what that piece of business was. And I learned a lot from Jeff in that respect. And like we talk about that a lot at the NWA. We're like, I'm not worried about a great match so much as I'm worried about a great piece of business. Wow.
And now with NWA, you have so many great matches that you've done. And, you know, we saw the crossover last year at All In, which was you and Cody, which I thought was really well done. Are you excited to see what they're doing now with the promotion that they're starting out?
I'm excited to see how all of this is going to unfold.
Yeah,
really, I am. You know, and I hope the only thing I really hope for is that I hope it doesn't turn all the boys against one another. Like, I really don't want this to. There's no need for any of this to be a war,
right?
You know, and like, and I feel like some people in this are kind of looking at it the wrong way and are looking at it as war. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. Everyone's assembling their troops, and you know. We're gonna like, and it's. I think that's the wrong approach, you know, because that's how that, you know. If there's plenty of money to go around, right? There's plenty of, just make a good product,
right? Exactly.
You know, we've already experienced some a couple of shady, underhanded things, and we're going like, really, like. We are not a threat to you. You know what I mean? Like, we're not a threat to anyone. Like, why are you? Like, you know, worry about your own product. You know right. what I mean? Like, you know what I mean? Like, cut your own fucking grass.
Yeah.
And like, and it was like, but you know, so that's my only hope for this unit. But in the meantime, I'm so proud of Nick and Matt and Cody. Nick and Matt, especially for their sort of, you know, getting to make big money. You know,
yeah,
like ultimately, like that's the best achievement you can make in this business is to get paid really, really well to do it. And you know, they've never lost sight of that because they have kids and they have, you know, and they got bills to pay, and they're businessmen first and foremost, and I respect them for that. I really do. And then Cody, you know, obviously with All In, considering when you think about, I'm not trying to brag, but like when you think about what I've done outside of WWE, you know what I mean? Kurt Angle, AJ Styles, Samoa Joe, Jeff Hardy, Bobby Roode, Sting, you know, like...
Mm-hmm. Oh, without question. You know,
and then when you think about Cody's career in WWE, and to think that we made that match between us All In the biggest moment of both of our careers.
Right.
Yeah. It was, you know, great.
Yeah.
And, like, that's a pretty cool feeling to think, like, we did that, you know? It wasn't someone else sort of waving their hand over it and going, this is going to happen. You know, we genuinely all came together, our different paths all culminated as one thing, and we made it work. Cause it wasn't like we were all, you know, Cody was under contract to Ring of Honor. I wasn't, you know, like we were,
right.
It was literally all just kind of like, hey, this would be cool to do.
Yeah, why it was very organic.
We can do it. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. we can totally do it. And mm-hmm. it was like, I knew Cody wanted to do it before he even said anything. Wow. I could feel it. I remember saying to Dave Lagana, Cody Rhodes is going to want a title match.
Definitely. Like, no.
And then I went and I said, I remember saying, like, I said, it may not be that big All In show, but it may be as well. You know what I mean? This was like way before. And then when it happened, I went, as soon as Dave said to me, you know, Cody just reached out to me, I was like, all right, that's happening. We're going to wrestle it All In. You know what I mean? Like, I just knew right away.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
And so Cody and I, and obviously we had that match, and then the match in Nashville, which in my opinion was so much better than the one in Chicago.
Yeah.
It's like when you have good matches like that with someone and you have those sort of moments, it's like it doesn't matter who you're working for or like what, you know, what anyone's doing. It, like, our paths will go in different directions, but we'll always have that sort of respect for each other, and there'll always be that little bit of desire of like, we want to do that again.
Definitely. And obviously you're doing some amazing things with the NWA currently. I'd like to shine a little bit of a light on the Aldous Crusade, which was the 20 title defenses over the course of 60 days in the spring of 2018. I mean, that's amazing.
It's not that amazing. It's, you know, I really didn't think that people would gravitate to that as much as they did. People, you know, talk about that a lot. Like, Ian always brings it up on Ring of Honor commentary and stuff. And like, I just remember saying that they're like, 20 matches in 60 days is not that much. Like, not by pro wrestling standards. Like, right. You know, certainly not if you're in WWE, you know, and like, they'd laugh at that, you know, right. And certainly not by the standards that I used to do when I first got in the business, you know, working in England. It's like most British wrestlers who are any good would go 20 shows in 60 days. Like, so what? Like, you know, I think it was the fact that I just happened to have those bookings.
Correct.
Most of which were before I won the title. So then when they all became title matches and we realized that people were actually giving a shit about the NWA again.
Definitely.
And about the title, because we had no idea whether anyone would care about the title, you know, about the title yet. Like, but when I first got it, like, we just kind of went, all right, let's just keep trying to build it and, you know, make it mean something. Well, and suddenly it was like, really quickly, people were like, all of those promoters were like, can we make it a title match? Like, oh, it'd be so cool. Can we get a title match? Like, will you do 10 pounds of gold at it? You know, and all that kind of thing. So, and that's how it all, and that's how it all came about. And so Dave came with me to England and we shot all those things, and that was just like, and it just ended up being perfect, because it was like, luckily going back to England first, obviously I had a bit more recognition with the fans there than normal,
right?
So it sort of put me on that sort of elevated level a little bit, and then after that he just sort of set the tone for everyone, because they went, this guy kind of feel, you know, all I've got from the beginning of this is people going, it kind of feels right, you doing this, you know. And that's really what it's all about, is like, the audience has to feel it before they can buy into it or believe it.
So, and speaking of the NWA and the championship and the lineage and history, when I reached out to you, one of the main reasons I wanted to get a hold of you, like ASAP, was because of the fact that at Cauliflower Alley Club, you introduced Dory Funk Jr. And I guess the burning question I have is, when you look at Hall of Fames, introductions, you know, anytime you're doing a presentation like that, a lot of times, almost 99% of the time, you're presenting it to someone either that you might be like 10 or 15 years younger that you kind of looked up to, or that it's a boy of yours that you might have been traveling down the road and you got stories and that kind of stuff. Here you are. This man is just an absolute legend. But we're talking 2 to 3 generations difference. And that speech just nailed everything. You couldn't have done a better job. Was that something that you had to sit down and write? Was that something that came from your heart? Was it something that, you know, sharing time with guys like Dory and Harley Race, you know, has built up that mystique and that respect even more so for what this title means and really what the business means and what your place in the business is now?
Well, first of all, thank you. There's a lot of layers to that question, but I appreciate I appreciate you that you enjoyed the speech. It's the simplest way to sort of set the table for this answer is to simply say that the reason that this works, I think, is because it's genuine.
Yeah.
Like, it feels real because it is real. That's something I say a lot. Because to me, I do genuinely have a profound respect for the history of the business, and I really enjoy studying all that old stuff. You know, I really enjoy going back and really getting into it, and it was a very serendipitous kind of situation that at the time that Dave and Billy reached out to me after they had taken, you know, Billy had purchased the NWA and they had taken over the brand, it was right around the time where I had been very much at a sort of crossroads, like, are you going to get out of the business? Because it's just not happening. And like, you know, you need, if you're going to do something else, you're going to need to give yourself some time to, you know, set yourself up for it and figure out what it is you want to do, because you're going to have to make a good living for your son one way or another.
Right.
And I remember, like, right around this time was when it was Mayweather McGregor.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And Canelo Triple G, and I was just so enthralled by all of the build to both of those fights.
Yeah.
That I remember just being, I remember like having this day where I was like really despairing, going, why can't we do that with wrestling? Okay. You know, like what happened, you know, like what, and it was like, I suddenly realized in my mind, I went, well, what you mean is, why isn't someone else doing it and then letting you be part of it? You know what I mean? Yeah. And it was when I talked to Dave and Billy, and that's why I think it was meant to be, because then when Billy started describing what he missed about wrestling and what he wanted from the NWA and everything,
right?
I suddenly went, that's what I want.
Yeah.
Like, I want it to feel like, like Jim Cornette says, like an entertaining sport versus sports entertainment.
Right.
And I want the big fight feel. Like, that's what it's all about to me. You know, it's like, it doesn't matter how you get there, but the point is getting there in such a way that by the time that bell rings, the people are so fucking ready.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like, and then to fast forward to like All In with Cody and I, it was like, I couldn't believe how quickly I manifested that vision into a reality. You know what I mean? Just by suddenly going, that's what I want to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then talking to Dave and Billy and going, this is what you know what I mean? I want to do this with you. And like, I think this is how we do it. And we all formulated this thing. And then the 10 pounds of gold thing started and everything. And the reason it means so much to me to go back to the Dory thing is that, you know, we're a YouTube show. Right. It's not like we're on, you know, it's not like we're on cable TV and everyone in the business is talking about us, you know, like, we were starting to gain some traction and people in the business were starting to talk about us. But just the fact that by the time we got, you know, I think by the time we got to All In, you know, it had resonated so much with everyone that like it had even made its way to Harley Race and to Dory and stuff. So then, because the first time they reached out to Harley, David reached out to him to get some comments about, you know, the title and everything for our stuff. And Harley was kind of like politely declined because he just sort of said, I've seen too many, you know, crappy reincarnations of the NWA. Right. Like, oh, I don't want to have anything to do with it.
Man.
And we were just like, okay, that's fair. You know what I mean? Like, you know, we'll have to try and prove ourselves. And then by the time it came around, you know, the next time he was like, hell yeah. You know, like,
that's awesome.
And the same with Dory, you know what I mean? Like when Dory stood there and, you know, said all those things he said in 10 pounds, like none of that, we had no idea what he was going to say, because I have too much respect for, you know, we have too much respect for him to like produce him.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so we just, Dave said, I'm just going to roll the camera. So just kind of talk to him, you know, ask his advice or whatever, and just, you know, trade stories. And then next thing you know, Dory's going like, I think you're doing a heck of a job. You're a wonderful champ, you know. And it's like, I can't even. And then when they contacted me about presenting the Luthez Award to him at Cauliflower Alley, I was just like, all I could think of was, like, to your point when you asked the question, was like, I'm 32 years old, and you know,
yeah,
Dory's almost 80.
Yeah,
and it's like there's so many people in between us that he could have asked.
Yeah,
you know, and they would have said yes. It's like the fact that he asked me is it's hard for me to fathom. It really is.
That says a lot about the, you know, the way you've taken your skill and now have made it where you have people who are, you know, legend is not even the word. You know, this is you know, royalty. This is
he's the founding father of our business.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, this is the respect you've. You know, started to earn, which is
yeah.
Just
it's like
amazing.
I said in the speech, it's like he was getting the Luthez Award.
Yeah.
But
yep.
Luthez is the only person to hold the championship longer than he did.
Yep.
You know, and it's like he's a true legend of the business, and like has done. You know, and I think that the generations that came just before the 80s, it's like are often sort of. Not deliberately, but just because there isn't as much history, there's not as much footage, it's hard to fathom just how successful they were. Like Bruno Sammartino, it's like when you talk about a box office attraction, it's like, you know, Bruno Sammartino is like almost in a class by himself.
Right. Exactly.
Like it's just and you know, and then like Dory having the title for 4.5 years because
yeah.
they were just because it was still drawing. It's yep. like, hey, Dory, you know, the world champion Dory Funk is coming to our town. Sell out.
Yep.
You know, like people can say whatever they want about whether they like the way he wrestled or not. Because, you know, a lot of people, obviously, his style was, you know, by the current standards is a little bit boring.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, no, you guys don't get it. Like, he was a master because he got people to buy tickets.
Yeah.
For 4.5 years straight.
Yeah, yeah, right.
To see him defend the title. You know what I mean? Like, that's. Unheard of these days.
Well, and I think the other thing too is, and I don't, with wrestling, we don't necessarily think of it in these terms, but being involved in the entertainment industry, my mind goes to before the 80s, what it is now is I think that a lot of the kids who look at wrestling, they look at it as the same way they look at black and white movies. They just don't want to watch it.
Yeah.
It doesn't hold their attention. Yeah. And they don't understand that some of the best storytelling that you can learn is by watching these pieces of art. Because at that time, you're right. Who the hell holds an audience for 4.5 years going from territory to territory?
It's, yeah. Well, and not just that. It's just, and it's also like just how far ahead of their time they were as far as like the physicality, you know, in comparison to what. You know, considering like they were inventing this stuff, they invented stuff that became the norm in our business.
Yep.
You know, like Harley Race, like was, you know, people always love to talk about, oh, Harley Race was so tough, he was the toughest man, blah blah blah. Yeah, that's absolutely true. But as a worker, he was also incredibly generous. Took tons of bumps, sold his ass off for everybody, made everybody look like $1 million.
Yep.
Like. You go and watch Harley Race with Jerry Lawler. You know what I mean? Like it's a masterpiece. Like, you know, the Harley Race, obviously Harley and Flair, Harley and Dusty. I actually think I prefer Harley and Dusty matches.
Yeah, I think Harley.
Harley loved it. Like, you know, because Harley's more of a bump taker.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like he works a lot more close. You know, more similarly to Flair than people realize.
Right,
and it's like.
And
God, he was the best. You know, you see so much of Harley Race and guys like Triple H, you know, who were just who were credible, but also, you know, sold and bumped and sold and bumped. Yep. You know,
and the other thing too is that you get a dynamic between the common man of a Dusty Rhodes and this, you know, arrogance of a Harley Race. That just played so wonderfully off of each other.
Harley had arrogance it was something I would associate more with the Flair character, but Harley had that air of invincibility.
Yeah,
like, he knew he was the world champion.
Yeah,
Like, he just, I know what you're saying. Like, he just exuded, like, it didn't come across as showy or, you know,
right,
inauthentic. It was 100% authentic, but it's like, I'm the alpha male here.
Right, exactly. Alpha male is perfect, versus the common man. And it's just like, how does that not sell? I mean, that is just the most beautiful thing, and everyone can learn from that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that when the NWA thing came along, it was only, you know, obviously as it started happening, we sort of realized how much it was just falling into place for us, because the one thing I'd constantly been told in my career was I was too generous. You know, like, I remember I did a show and Scott Hall was there, and you know, I was very fortunate to sit under Kevin Nash learning tree a lot at TNA.
Right.
So Scott knew that, you know, that I was quite close with Kevin, and so, you know, he was cool to me. But like, I remember I had the match once on an independent show, and Scott Hall was there, and he's like, what the fuck are you doing? He said that guy wasn't anywhere near good enough for you to be bumping and selling that much for him. He's like, what are you doing? You know, he's like, that guy, he goes, you should have gobbled him up.
Wow.
And like, and I was just like, come on, man. Like, I don't want to do that to him. You know what I mean? And he was just like, no, fuck that. He's like, he's not good enough. If he's not good enough to be in there with you, then like, don't lower yourself to be in with him. And I knew exactly what he meant.
Yeah.
Like, I had done that. Mm-hmm. And Scott, you know, that there's another guy. He's, you know, 6'6", jacked, like, looks like Tarzan, you know what I mean? Just, just like, such an alpha male, like, big athlete, super talented. But he would bump for people and he would sell for people and stuff, because he knew, but he would do it for the right people.
Right,
yeah.
You know, and he did it in a way that didn't, you know, that didn't make him look foolish. Like, it just, it was like, wow, this guy must be... And when he, you know, he expanded on that advice to me and sort of started laying it out to me like that, I really understood it. And then I sort of started applying that. And then, you know, the next time I saw him, I think by then I was doing the NWA stuff, and he was just like, champ. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it was just his little way of saying, like, I've been watching what you're doing. You know what I mean? Like, you know, and he was all in, and obviously, and all that. So he was just like, I'm really proud of you, Rick, you nailed it, you know what I mean? But I wondered, it was hard for me, because like, I had always been that way. I'd always been a generous guy in the ring. I've always wanted to, I think I work better letting, you know, that's just the way I like to do it. And a lot of my generation, for lack of a better term, don't have that same philosophy.
Right.
It's all a bit kind of like, what can I do to get myself over? And it's like, I don't think like that. Like, what can we do to tell a story and get the audience invested and get a reaction? And that's why I became so disenchanted with the business, because I was just like, all these matches are so like exhibition style.
Right.
You know, it's just, hey, look what I can do. Now look what you can do. Look what we can do together. Like this, you know, hooray. Like, and then I'll put each other over on Twitter. And I was just like, this sucks.
Yeah.
And I honestly had these conversations where I went, I just think I'm like out of touch, because I'm just like, I'm not doing, because I, you know, I want to still do it like this. And I would, you know, constantly just watch like Mr. Perfect and, Scott Hall and Bret Hart and like, you know, and I was just going like, no one works like this anymore. I'm kind of fucked, because like, this is how I trained myself to work.
Yep.
And then the NWA thing came along, and suddenly it was like retro cool, and all these people going like, oh, he's a throwback and he's so old school, the match with Marty at the Crockett Cup, you know.
Yeah, it was awesome.
It's probably the most universally praised match I've ever had. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, Cody All In obviously is the most talked about, but Marty's a close second. But the difference is that the Cody match at All In, a lot of guys sort of went, well, it wasn't exactly a technical masterpiece, but you know, I suppose it was good because the crowd were hot. And it's like, that's the only thing you need. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, that's how you measure, like, ultimately at the end of the day, that's how you measure a match, is like, so obviously it's my best performance in the sense of the, you know, the crowd reaction.
Right.
But the match with Marty is like, I I'm yet to see anything other than like universal praise for it. And I'm, you know, and like, I'm not saying that I agree or disagree, but it's like, what's funny to me is that they, so many people say this was an old school, you know, wrestling match. It was, you know, and I was thinking like, I'm not trying to be old school. I'm really not. I swear to God, I'm genuinely not trying to sort of do things like old school. Like, that's just my instinct.
Right. Exactly.
You know, and it's, and Marty wasn't, it wasn't like Marty was sitting there going, like, you know, he didn't, I didn't feel like he was working against the grain of his normal style either.
Right. Yep.
I think it's just the feeling we've created. So many people watching it are like our age.
Yep.
And haven't felt that way since they were kids, and they don't know what to do with it. They don't know how to deal with that emotion. So then they have to go, oh, it was old school.
Right.
And it's like, no, dude, it was just,
it was working. It was a good work. Exactly.
It, and that's, worked. Right.
Exactly. Exactly. Lucky.
Yeah. I mean, just an amazing match all around. I thought it was phenomenal. And for me, just the mechanics of the match, you guys, even though you don't really, you know, try to consider it old school, it just was a throwback in so many ways.
Which says a lot.
Yeah, I've always just tried to build things around moments, because I think back to, I've made a promise to myself really from the beginning of this NWA run is like, always try to look at it from the eyes of like the 15-year-old you.
Right.
You know, like, how would you react to this if you were 15 years old and you saw this, you know? Mm-hmm. And that sort of keeps my feet on the ground as far as like not wanting to sort of dig into the minutiae of like, oh, what would be critically acclaimed or what would be in to do now and stuff like that. Like, I just go, I'm focused on moments, because I think back to the things that resonated with me as a fan, and it's always moments. It's not like, oh, remember this amazing sequence of moves or this, you know, this match per se, it's moments.
Right, exactly.
You know, that's how I've tried to look at it now.
So you're here with the Vegas Bad Boys of Podcasting, and because we're Vegas bound, let me ask you, what is it about the city? Are there any favorite places? What's your draw? Do you see yourself maybe, you know, becoming a bad boy out in the Vegas area yourself?
I do love Vegas. And you know what's funny is that, like, the first time I went was actually for TNA when I debuted with the Main Event Mafia. I'd never been to Vegas before then.
Wow.
So I like a lot of people, I just thought of Vegas as the strip. And I just kind of went, I don't really care about casinos. I'm not a gambler. I don't, you know, I thought it looked cool, but I was just kind of like, well, it's just casinos. I don't really care about casinos that much. So, whatever. And then had, you know, never even really thought about the fact that it's like, in many ways, it's really the showbiz capital of America.
Yep.
You know, like, there's so much show business going on there all the time. You know, it's not like LA where it's like, well, that's where all the movies and TV shows get filmed and stuff. It's like,
right.
You know, it's actual shows, you know, right. Like there's music and there's Cirque and there's, you know, magicians, and there's just, it's like constant, you know, show business, entertainment, you know, like real show business. And I just love that vibe. Like, and it just, you know, it was cool before, but now that weed is legal, I don't know whether you guys felt it. I'd be curious to know how you guys feel based on like you guys living there. But to me, like, I would go, you know, I go a couple, you know, two or three times a year usually for, you know, depending on whether I'm going for business or pleasure.
Yeah.
But it's like, I remember after weed was legal, I just remember going there and just feeling like a totally different vibe in the whole city. Just like it felt like so much more of the city just sort of opened up for everyone and, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and there's, you know, it's really, that's a great observation, because two things basically happened at the same time, and that was, A, you had the legalization of marijuana, and B, unfortunately, you had the October 1st shootings.
Yeah.
So you had two really big impactful things that, you know, in different ways kind of interwove everyone as a community. And I think there's more of that sense now of, you know, just this very open vibe where there's so much love to be given to each other, where, you know, okay, you know, there's still going to be your jagoff who cuts you off, you know, in the middle of the afternoon on the freeway. But, you know, when you go to an event or you go to a bar, or there's not this nasty vibe that you kind of like you get in LA sometimes, or, you know, almost like a Midwesty feel, you know, to it now.
Yeah, it's, and well, yeah, like I get the same kind of vibe in Denver, you know, in Colorado, because it's like same kind of thing where people, it's a real unifying community thing where everyone's like, hey, like, let's just not be dicks to each other.
Yeah.
Like, let's try that. You know what I mean? Like, let's everyone just be cool to each other and then we'll see how that goes. Oh, it's way better. You know, I just felt like that's what happened in Vegas. So it's interesting that you kind of articulated that.
Any favorite places?
I usually stay at the Palms.
Oh yeah.
Like that's like, I just, I don't do very well with the sort of loud, dark, dank casino vibe. And like the Palms is like the so opposite of that. It's like, it's all bright and open and airy and natural light. And it's, you know, just the energy there is just, is like, is totally my wavelength, you know, like, so I stayed at the Palms last time I was there. I actually really like the Pearl Theater. Like I'm hoping we'll be able to do a pay-per-view there eventually.
Oh, that'd be awesome. Oh,
yeah. Perfect spot too. Yep.
Yeah.
Hey,
seems like an ideal kind of spot for us, you know, like, and we checked it out and it's like, I'd like that.
That'd be real nice. Nick, earlier we talked about you being an author, and I just gotta give you this opportunity to talk about the superstar body that you created. Would you mind telling the listeners about it?
Yeah, I got approached by a publisher shortly after I finished with TNA, and they wanted me to do a biography on my life, and I was just like, no, like, I haven't done enough. Like, who gives a shit? You know, like, I'm not doing like an autobiography before I'm 30. Like, that's so pretentious. And they were like, okay, well, do you want to, you know, would you like to do something? You know, we think that if you wrote a book, it would do quite well in the UK, and, you know, maybe do okay in the US, and like, we'd like to do something with you if there's anything you want to work on. I was like, well, I said, I've always felt like fitness magazines and stuff, they have a tendency to sort of recycle their information and then reconstruct it, you know, just to kind of keep it, you know, so they kind of deliberately keep you in the dark a little bit, because obviously otherwise you wouldn't need to keep buying the magazines.
Right.
And exactly. So, you know, I had a year subscription to Muscle and Fitness, and like, I'm not burying them, or, you know, I understand, like, they're in a business, you know, like, it's entertainment, but like, I remember I had like I got a year subscription back in the day when I first got serious about lifting weights and stuff. And I remember keeping them all. And I just remember like flipping through them like one day and like literally seeing on the cover of like the February issue saying like, you know, don't eat, like, you know, stay away from these five foods or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, and it was like eggs and this that. And it was like a recent study at the University of Bangladesh said that, you know, like, blah, blah. And then like six months later, you go find it's like, you know, five foods that you should add if you want to add real dense muscle, you know, it'd be like eggs, you know, shut up, you know, like, I was talking to the publishers and said, I'd love to do something where I could just create like a no nonsense kind of, hey, at least if you know this, like, you'll be able to get in somewhat decent shape. Like,
right.
If you want to get in great shape, you're going to have to dive deep. But if you want to be in okay shape, like, I don't consider myself in great shape. I consider myself in good shape. You know what I mean? Like above average, but I don't have any desire to eat like a monk and, you know, be like 5% body fat all the time. I'm pretty, you know, for the most part, I'm pretty cool with where I'm at. Obviously always sitting there going, oh, I want this, you know, I want my arms to be bigger, or I want this or that, or I want, you know, whatever. But it's like, for the most part, I'm, you know, pretty happy with my appearance. And it's like, I wanted to do a book that gave guys a resource for like, hey, if you want to still live like a somewhat normal dude, but have a good physique, like, here's what you need to know. And Kurt Angle, you know, wrote a guest piece for it. Rob Terry did some guest pieces for it. My buddy, my friends who run supplement companies, you know, they did guest pieces for it. Mickey even did a guest piece for it, and Brooke Adams and stuff for the girls, you know, and so. My friend Dwayne, who's an Olympic silver medalist in track and field, it's like they all did these little bits. And so that, in other words, I'm going, hey, the main thing about the book is like not everything works for everyone.
Right.
You know, every single body is different. And like, you know, just because if 9 out of 10 people eat cookies, you know, every night before they go to bed, like they're not going to be in the greatest shape of their life. But one person, it might not make any difference to at all.
Right. Yeah.
You know, like if they just have the right metabolism and the right environmental factors, the right genetics, you know what I mean? Like there's so many things. So it's kind of like, it's more about, here's all the stuff you need to know that pretty much is universally accepted that works.
Right.
Everything else, it's like, these are theories, but this is the shit that actually works.
Yeah, that's awesome. So, you know, I got a serious question for you. I followed you for a long time, and we just got to know, because you talked about it right now with the sweets. Who's got the better donuts, Krispy Kreme or Dunkin' Donuts?
you can't ask me to shift my allegiance now after they took care of me and Marty after the being the elite team. They gave us Dunkin' Donuts, gave us black cards.
That's so awesome.
Let me tell you, the first time I kept that thing for so long because I was kind of afraid to use it, because I was like, oh, like what, you know, like I really didn't want it to be one of those things where loads of people were behind me in a line and then it was like it became a big thing. Like it's funny, you know, I'm in real life, like I'm very introverted. I really don't like to make a spectacle of myself in public, you know, and stuff like that. So, like, the idea of, like, trying to pay for everything and people being like, what's this? Like, are you a celebrity? It's like, I've never seen this. So I did it at a drive-thru. Oh, and I remember I gave it to him, and it was like, even that was mortifying, because, like, this dude was like, yo, I ain't never seen one of these before. And then he's like, and he, like, swipes it, and, like, this thing comes up on the screen, and he's like, and he looks at it, he's like, he has my name on it, and he's like, yo, man, are you famous? Like, what is this? Like, I ain't never seen one of these before. And I was just like, something like that. And, you know, and he's like, hey, yo, like, you know, he's calling his manager over, like, yo, Steve, come check this out. And I'm like, and I was like, just give me my donuts. But, like, yeah, what, like, once I got that out of the way, I just kept going back to that same place, and I basically just used it to get loads of donuts for, like, my in-laws or like my friends and stuff like that. I just feel like, yeah, donuts on me.
That's awesome. But, do you have a favorite?
Yeah, it was a funny story. I don't know. I honestly couldn't tell you. I will say this: when I go up north, I do into Canada. I do like Tim Hortons.
The Tim Hortons, yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Really quick here, the show usually does a little thing here. Our guy Simon Street couldn't be with us today, but he has a little question he likes to ask every interview, and that is the oh shit moment. Is there a time in your life, in or out of the ring, that you can think of that you literally looked at and you went, oh shit?
Oh god, I've had many of those. Well, I think because I thought you were going in a different direction with the question, it's made me think of this story now. But I've had many, but all I can think of is this one off the top of my head. I got food poisoning on a house show loop when me and Joe were in a tag team.
Oh, no.
We were in some, like, we were like, TNA would do some pretty, you know, low on the totem pole towns, because we would draw better in those towns, you know. So we would do, like, you know, Pikeville, Kentucky, and sort of, you know, and then like, and then even smaller towns around that, you know, like that Pikeville would be like the big one, you know. So like it was somewhere like that, you know, nothing against the great state of Kentucky, but we were somewhere like really, really, like not a bustling metropolis, and we left the show and there was like nowhere open to get food. Like nothing was open except for a Subway, but it was like a gas station Subway.
Oh no.
And, you know, like there was a guy working behind the counter that looked like exactly like the squeaky voice teen in The Simpsons. And like, you know, he said, I get a sandwich and it's like, even when I was doing it, there was just this weird feeling in me, like, you shouldn't be doing this. Like,
this no.
Not worth it. Just get a protein bar and, you know what I mean, and call it a night. But no, like, I go through with it. 3 hours later, I'm just puking my guts up. Like, I'm just, you know, just in agony, like, just super bad food poisoning. Crimson was rooming with me. And Crimson was like, he's calling D'Lo, who is the agent, and going like, D'Lo Brown, like, he's in a really bad way. Like, he does it. He could, like, he's in the fetal position. He can't even stand up.
Oh boy.
And D'Lo's like, you know, well, just get him to the building, you know, and we'll see if we can do something here, you know, whatever. So like, he like bundles me in the car, like gets to the next place, whatever. And then like, I just about kind of recover enough, but just basically because I didn't have anything left to puke up. But like, I'm like, D'Lo's like, can you get your gear on and like, can you get to the ring and just kind of stand on the apron? You know what I mean? And we'll do some kind of schmoz, like dodgy finish or something. And I was like, I can do that. You know what I mean? So I get dressed. Me and Joe are getting ready to go out, and Joe's literally saying to me like, "Don't worry, dude. You'll be fine. I'll take care of you. Like, you know, it'll all be over soon. Like, you're good." I'm like, "Yeah, I'm good. You know?" He's like, "All right, cool. We'll just relax. Like, we'll be fine." Gail Kim's music hit, and Gail's match was before ours, so I knew I had about 2 minutes. You know what I mean? Like, like one, two, three, ding, ding, ding. Gail Kim's music hit. And I know that Gail's going to come back, and then JB's going to say a little something. You know what I mean? Like, who wants some backstage passes or something? You know, whatever. And I stood there, and it was like my stomach rumbled and kind of gurgled a little bit, and Joe kind of looked at me like, "You're right," and I'm like, "Yep." And then I felt like I was going to fart.
Oh, no.
I stood there and just like a fucking idiot, just shit my pants. Like right before I'm about to walk out. And I literally look at Joe and go, stall. Like, and just go fucking taking off. And Joe's like, "Oh, fuck." I go running off and like run to the bathroom. Luckily, the bathroom was really close.
Yeah.
So I got in there, just like pulled my trunks off, threw them away. Like didn't even look, just like threw them in the trash. Went to my bag, got my second pair, threw them back on just as our music was hitting. I walked back out like nothing happened. And Joe, like, we were walking down the aisle, and like to our music, and like it's like, you know, the world tag team champions, you know, like Magnus and Samoa and Joe. And, like, Joe's literally like, Joe's pretending to be like doing his usual kind of Joe shit talking stuff, and all the time he's just going to me like, "Yeah, my partner had just shit his pants."
Oh my god!
Yeah, that's dedication. He just shit his pants and he's still coming out here. Like, we're the best, you know. Like, he's like,
"That is awesome.
Nick, you okay?" I'm like, "Yeah, yeah." I'm like, he's like, "You're not gonna shit again." Now. He's like, "Just hold it." Like, brutal.
That's an all shit moment for real.
Well,
nobody knew about it at the time, because I kept thinking to myself like, "Oh god, like what if someone clocks and what if someone figures out, you know."
That's awesome.
Yeah, but like no one ever knew.
Well, Nick, so we're getting ready to wrap it up. I have one last question for you though. Except I'm a betting man, and I hear that you are a Game of Thrones fan.
Oh yes.
I need to know who's going to be sitting on this throne by the end of Sunday. I know you know the answer. Who's going to be sitting on this throne? I need to know. Please tell me right now. I know it's a tough one. I scratched off Jon Snow.
I don't even know. Like, it's like after that last episode.
Right.
I was like,
I know, right?
I tell you
who I think.
I think it's. I don't think it's going to be Sansa.
that's who I was going to choose. How do you, why do you say that?
I think it's going to be
Daenerys because she's got that that dragon?
I think Daenerys is going to come to her senses. I think she's going to turn babyface.
Well, she's looking like a mean heel right now. I don't know.
She just completely turned heel, but she's kind of gone like, because she's kind of like Austin. You know, she's like, so when Austin was like stunning referees and stuff, it's like, but you kind of liked it. You know, you're like, yeah, I know he's just, you know, he's been screwed over so many times. Like, I don't care. Like, I don't care that he just stunned an innocent referee. Like, I feel like, because, you know, there is a sort of justification to, you know, there is a little bit of a method to the madness. It's like, you just can't trust Cersei. I had to make sure Cersei was dead.
Right. Like, I agree.
So I just, I don't know. I get this feeling that they're going to work it out, but
yeah.
I feel like maybe Sansa's going to end up brown bread. You know what I mean?
Okay.
I don't know. I've been born and bred WWE, so I got a feeling John Cena's just going to get the crown.
Go back in your corner, Matt. Get back in your corner. Nick, thank you so much. We appreciate you with spending some time with us. And anytime you want to come on and promote anything or say anything that's on your mind, this is a platform for you.
All right, yeah, no problem. Thank you, boys, and I'm sure I'll be hitting you up for more Vegas tips and
Right. When you
it's definitely somewhere that we've talked about as like somewhere we, you know, if we ever want to sort of relocate or make a home base, you know, for the NWA or anything like that, like Vegas has definitely been one of the ones we've talked about.
Awesome. Oh, wow. That's what I'm talking about.
Well, you can't get rid of me that easy.
Well, we'd love to hang out with you when you come out here.
Right.
Yeah, okay. We'll think about that. I'll have to, you know, obviously vet you and background check you all.
Right.
You
know. Yeah, right. Exactly.
Especially this guy, because that's King Lucky. So definitely.
Do you guys know Adam Rotella?
I don't. Do any of y'all know?
No. Oh, you guys should. I should put you in touch with Rotella. He was like the first original new NWA super fan.
Oh, nice.
Wow! He was like the first super fan of like our, you know, of our regime, and he's in Vegas.
Oh, right. Oh, okay.
And he does a podcast like it's called 10 Pounds of Podcast.
Nice. Okay. Okay.
He's quite a character.
Oh, well, I'm sure. Especially he's a super fan.
Yeah, you should look him up. You guys could chat NWA business.
Oh, yeah, awesome. Absolutely. Definitely.
Well, no day.
I'm sure he'd appreciate a friend or two.
I love it. Hey, thank you, champ. We appreciate it. Everyone, that's Nick Aldis. Thank you much.
Woo! Thank you.